Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies Podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Mark Williams, Associate Professor of Film and Media Studies at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire.
wonderful. Thank you, Mark. Thanks for being here. And as I said to you before we were recording, it's lovely to see you. It's been too long.
It
And
has indeed. It has indeed. And I'm so grateful for the invitation. It's marvelous to see you as well, too.
It's a great opportunity for me. And Prof, I'd like to start, if I may, by asking you what's currently, in a sense, on your mind? What's dynamizing you, holding you back, preoccupying, or interesting you?
Well, there's a great deal. I believe very strongly that so much of the future of critical thinking needs to engage with film and media studies and just the increasingly mediated world in which we live. And part of my dedication to that is not only because I'm a historian and I know that this history matters, but also because so much of the world seems to be embracing a certain kind of mindset, let's say, that's rooted in what's been called the attention culture, that's extremely presentist. And one of the great flaws of that dynamic is that so much of even recent history, but especially longer history, is mutable, and people don't necessarily have the right filters or critical tools in the tool belt to recognize some of the fallacies that are put forward as, major political statements and gestures toward really dire actions, principally by autocrats. And that's really just so in vogue all around the world to be an autocrat and really play with historical terms and historical entities and dynamics to justify whatever it is their version of their autocracy should be. And it's a tried and true method. I think, in the West, we often consider that as one of the touchstones of historical fascism, for example. And, we don't need to dwell too much into that, but it is a great concern to me, and it's part of the reason why my own research is deeply embedded in getting to know bits of media history that aren't already well known and could very definitely play a role both methodologically and empirically in challenging some of those odd presentist assertions.
One of my concerns, Prof. M, is that often people who are writing about supposedly newer media forms, electronic games, for example, or artificial intelligence, would be two that we see a lot about today, do so seemingly without reference to the work on political economy or institutional history or audience responses in cinema, in television, in journalism, in drama. I find this puzzling because what seems to happen is that if they've been writing about these newer objects for about 20 years, they get around suddenly to discovering things that, if they'd looked at the history of telegraphy or telephony, they would have known before the millennium. Now, this sounds like grumpy old men, at least when I'm speaking. But I do think that's an issue, and that this presentism you discuss is a problem. It's not just a problem in terms of autocratic issues and fascism and so on. It's a problem in the way in which the media are analyzed in universities and in the bourgeois press itself, it seems to me. So
No,
I
I
did
think that's true,
appreciate
and
that.
you could not have known how much music that is to my ears, because I strongly so let me say a couple of things about that. I think there's a historical tension in media studies between something like an attention to close texts and aesthetics and so forth, and political economy. And I think that's a constructive tension. But there's also, I'm delighted that you brought up telegraphy and telephony. There's also an aversion, perhaps, to thinking about the long history of power relationships that evolve around, within modernity, the invention and application of electricity. It's just such a extraordinarily powerful dynamic, and it's absolutely quotidian. I mean, everybody is familiar with these things, but I still there are deep structures to that that we really don't have a grasp on, and we would prefer not to even think about it because it's there and it's available and let's go. And that the acceleration of exchange and just the unbelievable profundity of information flow is its own environment that seems to defer, or actually, I think I prefer provide a capacity for disavowal that literally is part of its power, is that people don't feel a need or a compunction or even a desire to think about it in a more complex way. And that's part of what I find troubling about the attention culture in general. And the power potentially of thinking much more historically and historiographically. I think it's absolutely necessary.
And Prof, you've used a couple of terms there that people may or may not be familiar with, and I'd love it if you could draw them out a bit. One is critical thinking, and the other is attention culture.
Yeah, critical. Those are great terms to. I can start to unpack. I don't really believe in authoritative universal meanings of things. I think that leads to a kind of hyper-binary thinking that's all too familiar, perhaps, within enlightened culture. But critical thinking is absolutely should be the goal of any kind of elevated study, I think, perhaps in any field, and it means trying to understand the precepts of the methods that one is using to pursue a better understanding of the objects one is studying, and come to a better understanding of the, and I'm going to keep saying history and historiography, of both of those things, both of the method and of the object. And I think the position that you were raising about more and better attention to political economy is invested in both of those things, and probably a third thing that sits in the middle that will, help to deconstruct those two things. So it's really, I tell my students all the time, we're trying to provide some different tools in the tool belt. And for me, a lot of that work can be greatly fueled by an attention to semiotics and just thinking how things mean, as a means of having a wider set of tools when we discuss what things mean and how they come to be and so forth. But it's so many, rich approaches to this, and not all of them are equally available in every historical period. I mean, it can be challenging to try and think about historical audiences, for example. And that's a challenge, but it's something that people find very creative ways to do. And the other term is the attention culture. So that is a catchphrase, I suppose. But I think has a lot to do with the rise of advertising and public relations and the investment in those kinds of pursuits, by which, with a certain manipulation of what we're calling critical thinking, one can understand that mass media in general and specific electronic media, increasingly, are interested in audiences, not so much as in the service of providing them a public good, but in the service of capturing eyeballs and ears and reversing sort of that common notion that these media exist for our entertainment and suggesting that these media exist for their demographic study and potential manipulation. And the attention culture is supercharged by not merely its electronic culture sort of dominance, but now this capacity to create new tools to analyze the data and the demographics of those audiences via algorithms and super fast computers, and the capacity within digital culture for these machines to quite literally process faster than our own brains do. And the attendant goal to perhaps, through the manipulation of so much and accumulation of so much data, sort of tell the future of the audience and not so much resolve the classic difficulty of advertising, which is, we're going to reach 20 million people, but we might actually influence 6 million. Having a fighting chance to be able to predict in the next at least 20 or 30 seconds what those audience members are going to do and what's going to make them feel fulfilled or happier or something. And that's a whole other level of potential manipulation that our brains might not even be able to perceive. So I'm not really trying to sound, alarmist and like a Jeremiah, but these are things to think about.
Sure.
these are topics that critical thinking should be attending to.
And Prof, you've mentioned pedagogy a couple of times in terms of teaching issues. I wonder if, particularly for audiences outside the US, especially because you have experience teaching in public universities, private universities, research one schools, and others, if you could tell us a little bit about what the profile of a Dartmouth student in your area is, and what their cultural capital, cultural background is, and how relevant that is to what you're teaching and how they participate.
I can try. It's a, I'm reticent to deploy, overly generalized terms. But Dartmouth, I actually tell my students this. I'm very privileged to be teaching at Dartmouth because I can assume that my students have a pretty good set of learning skills. And it means that it's really my job to raise the bar and make them work a little harder and make them, strive a bit to enhance, deepen, expand the critical tools in their tool belts, if you will. I don't want to overwork that metaphor, but it does tend to be the one that I use in class. But they come from very different places and they come from very different backgrounds. The student body, and I credit this in large part to the admissions office at Dartmouth. I've been there for some time, and in the last 10 years or so, the student body has become both so much more diverse in terms of race, class, ethnicity, country of origin, and economic status, and at the same time, so much more gifted. I think there's been a signal change from, and here I'm gonna, fall prey to the stereotype coming, from overextending welcomes to quote unquote legacy students and really working to strive for an exceptionally diverse student body and faculty. And that's a challenge when you live up in the North Woods sometimes to entertain that consistently. But I think there's a real commitment to it. And there's also a different emerging profile for how much financial aid is available to students. And I think that these are going to be really significant factors in just moving forward with that kind of a trajectory in various ways.
Just to explain to folks, legacy students often refers with reference to the Ivy League schools in the mostly private schools, though Cornell is partially public, in the northeast of the United States, where places are essentially reserved for the children of graduates, and this tends to go to the children of graduates who are very famous and or major donors. And it's become a wee bit of a scandal in recent times, as the Supreme Court of the United States has acted to diminish the liberty of private as well as public universities to look at different definitions and understandings of excellence in order to recruit students, clearly an attempt to stop getting working class African American and Latino, Latina students in particular into universities that are at the top of their game, at the same time as these schools who've pursued these policies in many cases excellently are still handing out places to sometimes numbskull children of wealthy men. I'm not asking you to comment on
Okay,
that just
that's
off.
your stereotype. I'm not gonna entertain that exactly. But it does produce and you know I think that's a perfectly cogent general introduction to it. It does mean that to some extent we also want to increase the enrollment numbers so that we can kind of do a both and. But the success that I have seen in putting faith. Pardon me, putting faith in the what the you know statistics suggest, which is that by producing a more literally diverse student body, the educational environment is stimulated and becomes itself greatly enhanced. And that has been definitely our experience at Dartmouth.
And in terms of when you're taking them through, say, textual analysis or institutional analysis, historical analysis, do you get people saying, Prof. Williams, you've spoilt my enjoyment of film forever, or I can't watch television like I used to, or whatever it might be?
They that that's some that's I think it's actually less the case now. I don't know, but I think the challenge to raise the level of critical acuity has become even more profound within the attention culture because the and I'll say that for a couple of reasons. One is the general sense of some sort of familiarity with the historical past used to be somewhat commonplace, and as we move forward in time, it just shrinks and shrinks and shrinks. So it's not just moving ahead as the generations and the decades move forward; it actually gets shorter as the decades move forward, and that's a challenge. But it means that you need to, you know, teach differently. And recognize that that's probably going to be the case, and that's fine. That's you know what good teachers should do is recognize the change in circumstance. But there's another change that I find, and I don't want to overstate this either. But it typically was the case that people at least had a sense of what are some of the skills and some of the areas to attend when watching moving image culture. And I think that's actually gone down. There are a lot of students, and I'm not saying this, you know, in an accusatory way, but a lot of students honestly don't know how to watch a movie. And they kind of read for, you know, plot points and characters and actors, which is, you know, certainly that's a start, but they could just as well have read a treatment. They're not paying attention to the expressive capacities of, you know, one of the great art forms in human history. And that means they're not necessarily paying attention to why it matters to look at films from different places and different times. And but it, it, it at the same time, and we've really had a wonderful visit to campus this week by Professor Vincenz Hediger from Goethe University. And we've had some wonderful class sessions, and he gave a great talk about the rise of principally African cinema and what he referred to as even hegemons within certain countries in Africa, and how that's very different from sort of the Western and oftentimes US hegemon. And the students really responded to that, and they asked some marvelous questions that, pushed back against some of the curriculum and said, why aren't we attending to this more? And it's not an easy thing to snap your fingers and switch to, but it's also, it meets a critical point in how the universities are thinking about the significance of history and the significance of investing in positions that are historical. That's part of the sway of the attention culture as well. But I congratulated these students and, was in a position to say, that's such a marvelous question, and thank you for articulating a desire for a different cinematic imaginary. And it's true. And I think it can be a both and how we respond pedagogically, both in terms of providing different skill sets and tools for them to attend, slowing things down a little bit, doing some close textual analysis, doing some better understanding of political economy, and try to bring that, tension between textual analysis and political economy into a new synthesis of 21st century pedagogy. Put this different generation of thinkers into relationship to one another and into relationship with the history as it now exists.
I had an interesting experience 2 or 3 years ago, Prof, when I was part of a team asked to evaluate a film program at a particular school in New York City. And the students, to a person that we spoke to, we have got a pretty fair cross section, I think, were concerned that they had to watch Hitchcock. They had to watch Riefenstahl. They wanted to see more African and African American filmmaking, more Latin American and Latino filmmaking. And they just felt they were being swamped with a white canon. And part of this was because their sense was that the faculty was not coordinating very well. And so similar films and problems would be used in seemingly very different classes. But part of it was also a racial and to a certain extent class tension, and I guess a critique of the canon, something that has been around in literary studies now for decades, and I guess you could say in film studies as well, perhaps a little slower to take hold, right? But it does seem to me this is part of a tendency and a very positive and powerful one. Of course, the great African, Arab, Asian, Latin American thinkers are all very interested in the Enlightenment, and they know a lot about it, and they know a lot about Western, so-called Western culture, and they like a lot of it and think we should all understand it. So there is some sort of balance issue that's hard to get at, especially if you've been reared in one of those cultures, typically a sort of white-oriented or white-driven one. Do you know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean, and it's I that's what I was perhaps too abstractly referring to as articulating these desires for a different cinematic imaginary. You know, these were students of color. They were students from non-Western parts of the world, and I was so gratified
Yeah.
that they had the insight and the presence of mind and really the guts. You know, these are
Yep.
undergrads. Almost
Yep.
all students of Dartmouth are undergrads. To put this forward. And it was just a wonderful moment of recognition for everybody in that kind of way. And I think I think has everything to do with what we're currently hoping to achieve with my research project, the Media Ecology Project, which really wants to work with a couple of realities. One is that a great deal of moving image history is imperiled. Most people don't see that as even conceivable because there's, you know, so much information on YouTube and it keeps getting huger. And isn't it all there, you know? And if it isn't there, does it matter? Both of those are troubling assumptions because no, it's not all there. And even the stuff that's there is going to turn to dust without, you know, more of a conservational approach to things. But also, it's just so much information that we might literally think of as almost fugitive in a way, that's still to be discovered and really will be genuinely inspiring and enlightening regarding the history of really all cultures since the late 19th century. But the traditions of film studies, as you're suggesting, in the West come from that an attention to that standard, you know, kind of pipeline that stands in for all things international, which is just Europe and the US. And trying to get outside of that pipeline is so necessary and so intriguing and so you know, also for a lot of people so threatening because they know that they don't already understand the questions or the answers. And yeah, people can be nervous about
But I
that.
think one of your great qualities is that you're not defensive about those things. Prof, I wonder if we could go on now to discuss two related things. First of all, another term you've just used, media ecology, what is it? But secondly, the Media Ecology Project, which you direct at Dartmouth. So, God damn it, what is media ecology, sir? I'm on your promotion and tenure committee at Dartmouth, and I don't get it. I'm an ethnobotanist. Come on. Help me out here.
It's so true. It's so true. So, yeah, I would distinguish between a couple of things. First of all, our Media Ecology Project was created out of a very ambitious endeavor in the United States to promote what's called the digital humanities, and that's another, you know, term that puzzles people, and you know, if they can't lock in a definition, they're even further puzzled by it. I think it's a very rich term because it's always going to be a term that's being redefined. For me, digital humanities is precisely the articulation of a dialectic between the traditions of the humanities, which are about close textual reading at some level, and the traditions of the computational sciences, which is about working at scale. And if you don't have a lot of things to look at, you know, why are you looking at them? So it's an opportunity to really address that dialectic, especially for humanists to bring their research questions to the table because the computational people don't already know them and aren't necessarily going to pay attention unless somebody brings them up, you know. And it's an amazing field that traditionally has been associated with the study of what I would call word culture. You know, what some people call texts, and me being raised as a in post-structuralism with Roland Barthes saying everything's a text if you read it, you know, is very stimulating. But word culture, which I love, I was an English major when I was an undergraduate, but I love word culture, but I don't do that anymore as my main endeavor. And trying to study in comp with computational means, visual culture and moving image culture is just a whole other kind of ball of wax. So it's incredibly inviting and difficult. There are no easy buttons in digital humanities. Everything takes, some time and some effort. So we were invited to this big old and I think intentionally wanted to be global initiative by UC Berkeley and the University of Chicago, with the following premises that I think are still completely germane. One is, most digital tools have been made for the sciences. There's a crying need for digital tools in the arts and humanities. But if every institution tries to do everything, we're doomed because it's too vast. So we have to think progressively and think collaboratively and see what we can do. So Dartmouth was one of scores of institutions who were asked to participate in this, and they said, okay, you've got 7 minutes. What does your field need? And not really knowing quite how to answer that, I said, well, I live and work in the rural Northeast. I would like more access to my stuff. So, this is going to be digital something or another. Let's make more things available online and see if that provides new areas of methodological inquiry. And that's really where it gets started. And as if it was written somewhere, I was a few weeks later invited to my first Association of Moving Image Archivists conference, AMIA. And we were going to talk there about digital publishing, and we had just started an electronic journal. So that was a great panel. And at the end, I threw in those three slides from this other mammoth thing called Project Bamboo. And I said, oh, and by the way, I was just at this other conference and I sort of invented this sort of research inquiry, and I thought this would be a great group to brainstorm with. And the panel was over, and there was a nice discussion. And then four archivists made a beeline for me and said, tell us about those last three slides. We want to work on those three slides. So that was a huge shot in the arm. And I knew that I would be able to work with people who already knew the kinds of standards and various technical questions that might be significant to address, but who also recognize that professional archivists are, I mean, they're treading water. They're practically drowning because they have such a great responsibility to so much information that the capacity to employ computational tools to those kinds of jobs is extraordinary and will best happen in league with higher education and people who are also invested in those kinds of materials. So it meant we were going to change the direction of the way most scholars think about archives from just saying, gimme, 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 to something that was more cooperative and collaborative and forward thinking. And we tooled around with it for a bit, and then we had a big cross-disciplinary symposium at Dartmouth. This was in 2013. We kind of put our cards on the table, and we had archivists and librarians and scholars and collectors and what have you. And we assumed that it would be a sack of cats and we'd have to reassess. And it was not at all. And people completely saw the value of this and said, here are the ways that we can help, and here are the things that you should try to build to move forward. And it was, just wonderful. So it gave us a sense of direction and a sense of collaboration that is just fundamental to, in my opinion, anything worth doing in the digital humanities. It has to be deeply collaborative. You are going to be working with people who do not use the same vocabulary in the same ways. There's going to be dissonance. There's going to be hurdles. There's going to be little flare-ups or what have you, and you know that going in, and you work to get over them, and you continue to make progress. And we've had wonderful success in that regard. So I define our project as working toward a virtuous cycle. And by virtue of having access to historical materials, whether it be from an archive or another institution of cultural memory, or even some other kind of source, we can work to develop genuinely interdisciplinary research methods, which is again going back to that dialectic for digital humanities, and do it in such a way to grow the field, if you will, film and media studies, cultural studies, what have you, but also in a way that will add value back to the participating archives. So we both want to try and save media history and grow the field of approaches to media history, and even potentially find successive research questions that these archival materials might be utilized in. So always thinking about the value back to the archives. The easiest way to add value back to an archive is to enhance search and discovery. But there might be, many reasons to study the earliest years of cinema. Not just one pass. There might be multiple passes to think about formal and aesthetic kinds of issues, but audience issues and all kinds of different parameters. So that's what we've been up to. And, of course, with just the nature of funding, you start with domestic sources and archives, and we've had great success working with the Library of Congress, working with the National Archives, working with the UCLA Archive. Those are the top three archives in the US just in terms of volume. And they're not opening everything up to us. We do, pilot studies within each of those. But then a great many local and regional archives, particularly regarding, we got a very nice NEH grant to work on the discovery and to some extent, the collation of different small collections of television news film during the famous civil rights era. So many people are familiar with kind of the national network news coverage of these kinds of things. But, early television in the US was basically structured the way that radio had been structured, with local stations being able to apply for licenses, but then having a requirement to work in the public interest in order to maintain those licenses, because the airwaves were seen to be a public good. They didn't belong to any individual. And that meant that these stations were almost all of them doing the news and sending out teams of 16 millimeter filmmakers with sound people and capturing something and bringing it back to the station and then showing some sliver of that on the newscast. Most of the records of which slivers got on the air are not especially available. There are some interesting exceptions, but a lot of that footage is still around. A lot of it was, the stations don't necessarily think of themselves as having a responsibility to their archive, their local entities, and they've only got so much space. So a lot of it is gone, and we don't think much of it will come back. But there's a surprising amount that exists. And these are materials that very often have never been seen by an audience. They were seen like by the news station. But they exist, in some kind of quote unquote raw version. And I just started becoming familiar with some of this footage, and it was so extraordinarily inspiring. And a lot of it was just desperate. A lot of what the materials that we work with are just desperate for more context. They're kind of little fragments in the sea of this ocean of footage. but completely worth attending to and making available to a much larger public to grok with and think about and, mobilize in different ways. So that was a very exciting project. We've had a really great early cinema project and this civil rights project and many others. And we have a Mellon grant now to start to work on some of those formal concerns regarding the history of US narrative cinema up to, say, 1980 or something. But a curated collection of those films, and the curation includes quite a number of films made for African American audiences or Latino audiences or Yiddish audiences or what have you. So, quote unquote, minority cinemas within classical cinema. And then this, we're really trying to make a strong turn to become far more international in our pursuits and in our collaborations. And after a long period of time that was gravely threatened by COVID, that's a trauma that we really haven't come to understand yet, that whole period. But we were working to build a memorandum of understanding with Shanghai University, and that is now successful. And that has developed over the last couple of years into a fairly large project. Through their generosity, we now have well over 400 examples of Chinese film history, which are just not easy to come by in the West, at least in my experience. And some really fantastic scholars who want to work together on developing studies of those films. And that includes colleagues in universities within China, but also some great people in the United States as well. We're hoping to develop increasingly a better attention to the history of cinema from Africa. And this is largely inspired by an extraordinary colleague at in Ottawa at what's his institution called? I'm dropping this. It starts with the C. There's an institute.
Carlton.
Carleton. Yes, thank you so much. Carleton University in Ottawa, a wonderful scholar named Aboubakar Sonogo, who is from Burkina Faso and is just one of the leading scholars of the history of African cinema, but has this kind of archivist mobilization at the heart of his scholarship. So he recognizes that largely because of infrastructure issues, there are few functioning archives on the continent of Africa. And as a result, the history of African cinema is its own material diaspora that lives in archives elsewhere. And, oftentimes through, curious circumstances, and they are not necessarily a priority in those archives. So he is working very diligently to identify where those films are, make them more of a priority, work to conserve them, and we want to, support that work in every way possible. And then through our tools, maybe even produce more of a capacity to provide access to those films back on the continent and more tools to think about them and let them have the respect and the influence that that they might have. And with working with Professor Hediger, he's been part of a couple of very significant collaborative efforts to discover and conserve and start to restore films from both Nigeria and from Ghana. And they're both extremely rich, histories. And he has a very important functioning master's program at Goethe University about film archiving. that's very international, and we're really looking forward to working with him and expanding through our a different project with the National Archives in the US. We are pioneering the study of a curious entity called the Film Collection of the US Information Agency. I'm guessing you're very familiar with the USIA, but they were a major diplomatic branch of the US government during the Cold War. And they set up viewing centers, cultural centers all over the world to make people more familiar with US culture. And it was to make them more familiar with US culture as in competition with Soviet culture. And they produced or distributed over 20,000 films. Curiously, or not so curiously, those films were not allowed to be seen in the United States. Now they can be. So this is literally a kind of a fugitive archive.
Well, this was the part of the enabling legislation, which was to get around the First Amendment by saying that the work of the agency, which was called a service outside the US, would not
Indeed.
be subject to judicial intervention domestically.
Right.
I mean, I think that was the point. But you're absolutely right, Prof. I did spend time actually looking at microfiche in their centers of coverage in everything from Commonweal to the Nation, of the Weather Underground, Weather Man as it began. And of course, the other thing that happened was that I think under JFK, they got a sudden injection of funds, which included, I think, sending literally more than 1,000 projectors to different countries.
They have a fascinating history that has yet to be fully realized, and this is part of what our quote unquote international undertaking is to work on this. So there were a couple of fantastic at the time grad students and now doctorates who I really need to name. A wonderful student from Carnegie Mellon, Brett Vuokoder. And a student from NYU, Hadi Garabaji, and they were inspired by our work, by the MEP work, and said, "Could you help us get a better relationship to the National Archives?" And I said, "Absolutely, we'd love to have a better relationship to the National." So we took the meeting, and I confirmed that those were indeed the details, that these were films largely, almost entirely unseen in the U.S. But it was okay to see them now, et cetera. And the NARA is digitizing them at a pretty good clip. They don't have 20,000 films, but they have thousands, you know. And I said, well, we would love to help stimulate new scholarship about those films. But I have another thought. For every good reason, in all those historical contexts that we just described, there are very few scholars in the US who are going to be familiar with these films. But there might be a lot of scholars outside the US who are very familiar with these films. Let's invite scholars from outside the US to teach the US about its own cultural product. And I thought that might get crickets, but they loved it. And we've completed a first year of an NEH grant thinking about these international legacies of the USIA, including the fact that they had filmmaking units in select parts of the world and taught people how to make films. And once you teach somebody how to make a film, you can't tell them what to make a film about, you know? So there's a long tail that's interesting, but also a long tail of what they did do and how ham-fisted or not ham-fisted. I think our experience has been that it's actually a surprising, latitude of representation, but all of it, you know, in the effort of recognizing that the US could be a good friend, right? That was really the mission. But especially, you know, and Abubakar is wonderful in thinking about this, the mission in Africa in that era of post-colonialization with so many different kinds of countries experimenting with different kinds of government and state organizations and so forth. It's a fascinating cornucopia of issues and approaches to issues. And there's an enormous paper trail regarding this that's also at NERA, and it's not at all well organized. So that's going to take some time to better understand. But it's already been so enlightening. And we're doing a bit of a both and with those materials, because we don't want to reproduce a kind of hyper binary, ham-fisted approach to the materials themselves. We want to find and see the materials and see what results will occur. But many of the films are ham-fisted, and we're going to call them for what they are. And we're just extremely interested in having more opinions and readings from places other than the US about the films. And I think that will produce its own extraordinary complexity of responses. So it's exciting in that way. And will lead to, just to circle back again, we're very interested in trying to develop new alliances and collaborations with, pardon me, with different archives in the Global South. We love working with our colleague Juana Suarez, who you may know from NYU, who really knows those archives as well as anybody I've ever met, and she's a huge help in that regard. And also, we're working with materials from China. We're very interested in continuing work with people from East Asia and Southeast Asia and South Asia. And we know that the archives for example, in India, whether it be the huge archive of sort of narrative cinema, or even the archive of the Films Division, which was initiated in as a domestic documentary informational and experimental entity of the government, the post-colonial government. Those archives are sort of slowly being, defunded in a way, and there's a real need for these issues to be addressed and for us to recognize that we're in a position to develop new insights and new kinds of critical tools to understand them in their complexity and make them available for that kind of new historiographic reflection.
Prof. Williams, I want to thank you very much for your generosity in explaining so many things to me today, some of which I vaguely knew about, some of which I didn't know about at all. And I think that will have been incredibly helpful to our listeners. So,
I'm so
thank
I
you.
would be so happy if that's true. And I really want to thank you. I'm so delighted to be invited to this conversation, and let people know that we really would like this to be something that we can help people to build from the ground up. And we're very open source, open everything. We're not creating some kind of restricted grubbing exploitative set of tools or something. We want this to really help to better understand the history from many perspectives in many places. And please be in touch if you're interested. And thank you so much, Toby. It's a delight to see you and talk to you.